Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence. Chevrolet, the all-new Chevrolet Cruze. Get used to more. And by Dow Automotive Systems, innovations for clean powertrain solutions.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 88 for Thursday, January 27, 2011. Distracted in D.C. Watch Autoline After Hours live at autolinedetroit.tv every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern or 2400 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline After Hours in the iTunes Store. So welcome to After Hours. We're coming to you today from Washington, D.C., the nation's capital. We're here in town for the Washington, D.C. Auto Show. Unfortunately, Peter DeLorenzo is not here tonight. Peter's holding the fort for me back in Detroit. He's been hosting Autoline Daily the last 2 days. He'll do it again tomorrow. In fact, if you haven't seen it, go see his editorial slash rant that he did in yesterday's show. It's terrific, where he really takes on Dan Akerson from General Motors. I highly recommend go listening to that. But joining me right now are Jane O'Donnell from USA Today. Great having you here, Jane.
Nice to be here.
And Joe White from the Wall Street Journal.
Great to be here.
And hopefully, I know he's just landed, so we've got word, Kamatni Rollins from Automotive Rhythms is going to be joining us later, too. So can't wait to have Kamatni join in the conversation, but So what's going on here in D.C. these days, automotive-wise?
Automotive-wise, well.
Well, right now everybody wishes they had an SUV because there's about half a foot of snow outside, which in D.C. is the same as 2 feet of snow in Detroit.
Because you're from Detroit.
I'm from Detroit.
So cities don't shut down other than with
Western
kind of
cities
snow.
Don't shut down when you get 6 inches of slush. In Washington, D.C., no one can get around
everybody,
anywhere.
The cars are abandoned all over my town.
I got an email from Smart. They delivered a Smart Electric 4.2. Some nice woman in suburban D.C. in Silver Spring, Maryland, and I imagine that she got no use out of that today because the thing was if she could find it in the snowdrift, it probably wouldn't start. So, but I think it's the annual ritual where the car makers come to Washington D.C. and talk about green cars to the exclusion of the cars that they actually sell.
That's right.
And it's very
what
amusing.
Is it 2% now? 2% of cars sold hybrids. Are hybrid or electric. Obviously, electric is
2.4% or whatever it is.
Right, and somehow between now and 2015, the car makers have got to figure out how to put a million of these on the road in order to satisfy President Obama's proposal or challenge in the State
of the Union. Well, because of the State of the Union.
Yeah, so I think that's certainly one of the things that's going on is the sort of the gap between promise and reality. Today's reality.
Right. Aren't some of the environmental groups predicting that by 2025, 60% of auto sales can be hybrid and electric?
I don't think it's that high, but I know by 2020, Carlos Ghosn, the head of Nissan, has said that he's...
No, but this is the environmentalist. They're always going to go out there a little farther.
Right, yeah. if you throw hybrids in there, and if you include the stop-start technology, you know, when you come to a stop sign...
In other words,
you
have a very elastic definition of what a hybrid
right.
is.
Right, but if you're talking, you know, electric car ain't going to happen, not in that time.
Not without some changes in the environment, and I don't mean the climate. I mean the financial and the fuel environment.
Well, that especially
around that
price of gas.
Because if the price of gas is relatively low compared to incomes and compared to you know anything else,
only the true believers are going to get
only the true believers will invest in electric cars. And if there's no fuel recharging infrastructure. And we talk about this a lot in Washington, D.C. If you live in a townhouse on Capitol Hill, which I happen to do right now, you can't recharge an electric car because
there's no place to plug it in,
a garage, and you're not going to run an extension cord out across the sidewalk to the street wherever you're. If your car is within 50 or 75 feet of your house, good luck with that. So the whole
and even just, that didn't work when I had the Nissan Leaf, by the way.
So
why? What do you mean?
It wouldn't charge it. I thought it charged overnight. I got the extension cord out.
I had the same thing happen to me.
Yeah. So there's a lot of slips between the promise of a million vehicles and sort of this becoming a mainstream technology. The cars work, But the whole package isn't quite there yet. And so it'll be interesting to see how that gets done and to what extent the car companies are able to get the Republican House of Representatives to agree to put up more subsidies to pay for it. And I happen to be a bit of a skeptic on that right at this very moment.
No, I would agree with you completely. And, you know, also I'm wondering, why has the administration really focused on electrics? I mean, there's other alternatives out there that work pretty good. So why not clean diesel?
I think they just listen so much to the environmentalists. Environmentalists aren't big fans of diesel.
No, they're not. No, they're not. Doesn't matter how clean it gets.
It just became very clear very early on in this administration that they really had the environmentalists really finally got an administration that was really going to, you know, do their bidding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's right. I think that the environmental community in the United States has never got over their distaste for diesel and their. Even though there were some glimmerings of it, I remember a few years back, we wrote a story in the Wall Street Journal that the head of California Air Resources Board said something nice about diesel, and it was a big deal. He didn't really say it twice. I was at the auto show. I walked around the floor, it is a head scratcher because here on the floor is a BMW X6, and I know some people don't like the X6, but let's just forget that for a second. Here's a BMW X6 hybrid. I think the sticker price on the thing was $89,000 plus. And the mileage, I don't remember the mileage off the top of my head, but I want to say that it was something like 17 and 19, maybe 20, but I don't think it was 20. It certainly wasn't 40. And so this is a hybrid. And it's fine. It's a wonderful piece of technology. But you said if you really wanted a high mileage X6, you would get a diesel.
Right.
And I don't know what the diesel, I imagine they sell it with a diesel in Europe. I assume they do.
Oh, absolutely.
And I don't remember what the mileage is off the top of my head. I wish it did, but I'll bet you it's better than the mileage of the thing that I saw on the floor today. And you said, well, you know, if that's what you want, why don't you just do that? But that's not, the regulatory scheme is against it. There's no, the diesel prices are upside down half the time, right? They're higher than regular gas.
Typically, yep.
Often. And,
right.
And I think that even, it's just going to put a damper on diesel, even though for a lot of people, especially people who drive long distances, it's probably a better solution until you can get an electric car that really does go 300 miles between charges, which we don't see yet.
Yeah.
I think another thing that's interesting that's going on right now is how they managed to convince California to kind of come out at the same time with the CAFE proposal.
Yeah, that's an interesting dance to watch. Yeah. And I gather there were discussions going on amongst people like Ray LaHood, the transportation secretary.
Yeah, I think he really pushed him, didn't he?
I think so.
Going back to what you were saying earlier, Jane, of here's an administration that's really listening to the environmentalists. So it's like Nixon going to China, right? How do you get California to come on board? You got to have somebody who's really looked favorably upon by the environmental community, especially the one in California.
Yeah, I think that's right. But I also think it's a two-way street. I think you do have the administration, and certainly the auto industry is pushing the administration, sending a message, look, we've got to be somewhat reasonable here. We can't kill the auto industry.
And his old LaHood's buddies in Congress are pushing him
absolutely.
To be a little more reasonable.
Absolutely.
With California.
I mean, you don't want to.
He's a Republican, don't forget.
Right. You don't want to create a situation where the auto industry is building cars that people don't want to buy, or taking on costs to comply with an aggressive regulation that they can't handle. And so I think there's a delicate dance here.
And I wonder if you did a national poll, and I'm sure it's been done, how many people outside of California agree with the idea that they should be able
well,
to...
You know, in well, the Northeast here, you know,
Northeast,
a number of
yes.
states have oh, taken right. California's
Ohio, no.
laws.
Yeah. You know, or not as much.
If you carve out the Northeast, you probably wouldn't get any votes.
Yeah. I mean, the trouble is they're trying to come up with a unified regulation, which, of course, the industry wants, for a country that's not unified on this issue. And it's not unified for some... It's not unified in some cases for logical reasons. I mean, if you're living in a densely populated city like D.C., you don't really need a suburban unless you happen to be a high government official.
But they have them anyway where I live in McLean, Virginia.
Right.
A lot of Range Rovers. A lot of crashes between Range Rovers and Mercedes.
But they're very safe. Lots of airbags.
That's right.
Well, speaking of the regulatory climate, you cover all kinds of safety stuff,
right?
Yeah,
I focus more on the safety than the
environment. And driver distraction is a big issue
now,
right?
Yeah, I just did a piece on that. I've been dying to do a piece on that for a long time.
So what was your piece about?
Well, I just focused on what some say is a... an administration, or at least the transportation department, that's distracted by distraction. There's a lot of people, and, you know, as Joe knows from being a reporter, you know, often half the people, you know, maybe only a third or a quarter of the people you've talked to or actually end up in the story. But a lot of people had been talking to me about how frustrating it's been that just Ray LaHood has moved the debate to distraction. I moderated a panel at the Swedish embassy this past December. Their fatality rate is a third the fatality rate in the U.S. now. Some automakers say to me, but they're socialists. And, you know, but let's just look at that for 1 minute. A third of the fatality. And they think we're crazy to focus so much on distraction. That's not what works. Now, a 0.02 BAC works there, and it ain't going to work here.
Well, that's it. I mean, I didn't see your article, but I ran across a study that was put forward this week at one of the SAE, Society for Automotive Engineers, sessions. And you probably saw this, University of Michigan researcher, and I don't remember all the numbers, and it's fine that I don't, but he made this exact point. He used a bunch of statistics, and he said, and he had a slide in a presentation, his name is James Sayre, or Sayers, the elephants in the room. And, you know, he said, look, alcohol is a bigger problem, by far.
Yeah, speeding.
Speeding is a bigger problem.
Alcohol is a third,
speeding is a third
of all fatalities.
Motorcycles, people, you know, crashing and not having the proper protection on motorcycles, big problem. And he said that driver distraction, and particularly cell phone issues, are not 25% of all crashes, which I think either the DOT or advocates who are behind who are supporting the DOT have put out there.
But they say it's growing. It's not even growing. There's no evidence
it's growing. It's actually declining. Yes. According to this research, it's declining.
Yeah. I haven't seen that. I've got to see
it. And it's something like 3%. Maybe of crashes are cell phone related, depending on how you want to count.
Yeah, something like that. It's like 16% distracted driving.
Right, and his point is, you know, the people are self regulating. Now, not everybody is, you know, and you can the anecdotal evidence that there are people who behave very badly with cell phones behind the wheel is everywhere. I mean, you know, my kids.
No one's in favor my kids, of it.
We see them every day.
Yeah.
My kids, one in particular, behaves badly with an iPod behind the wheel, and you know. And I've mentioned this, but it's not that it isn't a problem. It's not all one or the other. But I do think that, and Jane, I think you're right. I think that there's starting to be a bit of a pushback on this, saying, you know what, it's a problem. Is not the biggest problem.
But, you know, and I'm sure you probably don't look too much at state legislatures, and neither do I, but when you look at, in the last 2 years, they got to 30 state legislatures have passed these laws, and you probably know,
right.
Like, IIHS got the debate started on this.
Right.
But it took 25 years to get that many states to pass seatbelt laws.
Right.
And, like, if every state, if these guys were focusing on seatbelt laws or child protection or fixing the booster seat laws that are very inferior, and there's research showing they work, look how much safer we'd be. But it's politically correct. Nobody complains, right. So they passed texting
now,
laws.
Now, let me stick up for the DOT just for a second, because it's, I think you're right. Ray LaHood has made a public campaign.
Yep.
I do think, and I interviewed David Strickland, who's the head of the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, NHTSA, this week. He's all about dealing with distraction, and he talked about how NHTSA wants to have this year voluntary guidelines that they will promulgate to the automakers. I think they're going to adapt.
Because of all the new technology.
Right. They're going to adapt guidelines that the automakers have already put forward and probably make them tougher. Voluntary guidelines on dashboard displays and distraction.
If it's not your phone, it's going to be right. Over
but
here.
But the other thing that he said, but he has more on his agenda. And I mean, the other thing that he talked about, it was really the first thing that he said when I asked him, what are your priorities, was I am trying to figure out what is the next stability control. Stability control is a technology that's clearly saved lives. I mean, there's lots of data and evidence to that effect. And he wants to figure out where's the next stability control so I can mandate it.
Yep.
And he's looking at that. And you know, there's more there. I think that the distraction thing has kind of filled the windscreen here for a while.
Yeah, but
I think you'll start to hear.
You met with Strickland, and some people do occasionally, but we don't hear much from him. LaHood's kind of stealing the limelight.
Why is LaHood going so it's not the big elephant in the room.
Well, he says it's because a kid, his people say it's because a kid died in his hometown, and he's just very upset about it. I mean, but in some people, and again, I'll defend DOT too. I mean, some of the doctors and others that I talk to say, well, it's good to finally have a transportation secretary who's focusing on injuries and this kind of thing. You know, it may not be exactly what we want, but he's making people think about it, and there's a benefit.
Right. And I think that the broader thing that I frankly expect you'll see the safety community and possibly even Ray LaHood talking about more is the issue is there's a broader issue behind that, and it's driver behavior. I think that's right, because you've got cars now that are, in terms of passive safety, the crash survival, you know, nothing's as good as it can be, but they're really, really good. Mm-hmm. And you can get a Chevrolet with, 8 or 10 airbags in it or something, you know, and all this stuff. So you've got that. The next generation is coming out of cars that are going to anticipate collisions and do stuff like braking. They already have this. They're already doing it with adaptive cruise control, to anticipate and avoid a crash. So now the elephant in the room is that the guy behind the wheel or the woman behind the wheel is the weak link in the chain now.
Right.
Drinking,
fix the driver.
Misbehaving or being distracted, not being trained properly. There's the weakest link in the chain.
There's the weakest link, and let's hold that thought, because we need to take a small break here for one of our sponsors, but I want to come back and talk about that, because right now we got to thank Chevrolet for its support of AutoLine After. As MSN Autos is calling it, the Chevrolet Cruze is the class of its class right now. Comes with a 6-speed manual or 6-speed automatic, Pioneer premium 9-speaker sound system, more passenger and cargo room than the Civic, Corolla, or Focus, better high-weight manual transmission fuel economy than Civic, Corolla, and Focus, and gets an impressive 26-city, 36-highway. And you can learn more about it at Chevrolet.com/cruise, and that's CRUZE. Okay, so let's go back.
Say something about the driver. One of the funny things I found funny, it was crashes, it wasn't fatalities, so it can be a little funny, that of all the things that distracted people, NHTSA's own research, it was a study that came out this past September, talking to your passenger was the worst thing. That was like by 16% of the crashes were talking to your passenger. Now, of course, there's a benefit to that. It's better than talking on the cell phone, because they can go, you know, you're about to hit something. But, you know, almost tied with cell phones was picking up something off the seat. It's like we do bad things, but we also drop stuff occasionally, and bugs come in the car, and I mean, stuff happens, and which is why, you know, some of the people that have compelling arguments to me are the ones focusing on advanced safety, like the things you're talking about, collision mitigation.
Right.
And I'm starting to come around on these technologies just as a consumer. I used to get annoyed by lane departure warnings, and now I'm thinking, you know, I think I need them if they're going off so much. You know?
But here's the thing that I wanted to get into is, as you said, Joe, the weekly in the chain is the person behind the wheel. And so when I got my driver's license when I was 16 years old, I never had to drive on the freeway, never had to drive in rush hour traffic, never drove at night. Of course I never drove in the snow or anything like that. You had a multiple guess quiz. I guessed enough right. Boom, they gave me a license. And guess what? Today, driver's ed is even worse than when I got
my graduated licensing. At least delays it.
Licensing is a good move.
Graduated licensing, you know, is one of those things where, you know, again, there seems to be a body of research that's showing a correlation. I mean, I think the Center for Disease Control, and how they get into this, I don't really know. I guess because it's a public health issue. But there appears to be a correlation between declining numbers of teen deaths and the rising number of graduated licensing programs.
Another thing more states should be passing rather than worrying about.
And it's one of the, and it's not, correlation isn't always causation, but there appears to be a good reason to think that there's something to that. And my own kids in Michigan went through the graduated licensing program, and I got, and no, it wasn't, I had to pay a private, you know, course or instructor to get check off all the boxes. But it was a fair amount of instruction, and they did a fair amount of driving, and they had to do, I forget however many, they had to document that they spent, 20 or 30 hours behind the wheel.
And they couldn't bring their friends,
And they couldn't bring their friends.
That's one of the best things.
And couldn't bring their friends. And all this stuff, which
helps,
isn't maybe perfect, but it was certainly better than what you describe, was better than I had as a kid growing up in New York.
I mean, there's research that shows each, if you're a boy driving, us women don't have the testosterone thing going, but with each kid added to that car, I forget what the numbers are, but the risk of fatality goes up a huge
exponentially.
Yeah.
Exponentially.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, right.
Absolutely. No, you put three of them in there, you might as well not even pull out of the driveway.
Right. No, these are all things that your kids don't want to hear, but again, it's clear that you put more kids in the car, it's a big problem.
If you
don't sort of ease them into the driving, the responsibility of driving, it's a problem.
This is idealistic, I know, but, you know, I've gone through race driving schools. I had my daughter do the same thing. I think it's fantastic because I go back to the Ford Explorer with the tires that blow out and, you know, the thing go upside down and people getting killed. And I'm like, wait a minute. There's no way in the world that because you got a flat tire, you should go upside down and get killed. I mean, just none whatsoever.
Isn't it interesting? I mean, I'm a big fan of those classes too, those schools, and I'll send my daughter through someday. But there's actually no research to show, like IIHS, which, you know, would have a reason to say that it works if it's saving lives.
I don't think I don't think IIHS is interested in that at all. They want to regulate the car.
They say driver education makes no difference.
Well, I think they disapprove of teaching kids high performance driving techniques.
They're afraid they're going to try it.
But at some point, it's a good thing to understand emergency handling.
I
don't think we're going to get to the point anytime soon where the car is really going to drive itself.
We'll debate that because I think they will. But.
Well, I know you do, and I think they could, which is different from will. But we'll see. I mean, it's interesting. You look at what's on the auto show floor. This stuff is kind of sneaking in, but they're still kind of promoting either greenness and eco on one side.
Or horsepower.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
They do want to have it both ways.
Well, it's funny to me, you know, every auto show I go to, and it's not like I go to the mall, but I go to a number of them, they all brag, we're the green one. You know, nobody else is as green as us, and I don't care if it's Detroit or L.A. or Paris or here in D.C., they all say, we're the green one.
But here's the problem. If you look at what's selling, and maybe this month will be different, if you look at what's selling over the last year, what drove the auto industry's recovery was not sales of small cars. They actually, at least according to the numbers I saw, slipped.
They did.
And what boomed were mid-sized crossovers, small compact crossovers, to some extent mid-sized cars, and pickup trucks, right?
That's what people want.
That's what people are buying. And how you get, and again, sitting in Washington, this is kind of a relevant topic, how you get sort of the government view of what the American car park should look like.
And what it will look like.
And what it actually looks like, and what it's going to look like, barring, you know, a major change in gas prices or some other, you know, regulatory regime, is really interesting. How they're going to get to 35 miles a gallon CAFE, you know, fuel economy standard in by 2016 without some major push, I don't know. And how they would get to 50 or 60 by 2025, I really don't know.
I have a question, and I'm not even asking the questions here, but I haven't paid attention to this in a few years. Do the foreign automakers still go ahead and just pay those exorbitant fines for not meeting CAFE?
Sometimes, although I think they really would prefer not to. And that's why they're trying. I mean, if you're a German automaker, you not only have to worry about the United States, but you even more so have to worry about the home market, where there's much more pressure to kind of reduce the carbon dioxide emissions. And really, they all have to worry about China, because especially it's the luxury cars that are paying these penalties. And if the Chinese government, you know, the head of the Chinese government, whoever it is, rolls out of bed in 18 months and says, you know what, these cars all ought to be getting 35 miles to the gallon, that's it.
Yeah.
That's the biggest car market in the world. It's one of the biggest luxury car markets in the world. The whole world changes the minute that happens. That hasn't happened yet, but so they all have to worry about that. That's why they're hedging their bets.
And then what happens with I've always been fascinated by the size versus safety debate, which they've addressed a little bit with the attribute-based CAFE system. Mm-hmm. But I mean, there's still going to be some downsizing and some lightening and to meet some of the different targets.
Right. Well,
and you're
lighter,
better
for sure.
Off in a bigger vehicle, bigger, heavier vehicle. It's just the laws of physics.
Yeah. Well, and that goes to the issue of
but you
of
don't
how
have
much
to be. A lot of the environment will say you don't.
No, that goes to how much is a new car going to cost. Because to get, John, you would know this better than me, because you know this technology inside out, you can do light and safe, but you have to do, you know, different kinds of materials and different kinds of engineering. And you can't do, You can't do light, safe, cheap, and shoddy, right? You have to do light, safe, really high-tech, probably more expensive. Mm-hmm. And right? And so, again, this is the challenge you kind of see here. It's like, well, where's the balance? Where's the balance? And in the upper reaches of the car market, the balance may be do whatever it takes to get, you know, the top-notch safety, because that's a luxury attribute now. And, you know, lightweight materials, it's all good. We'll pay the money. In the lower end of the market, boy, I don't know.
Well, you know, you've raised a good issue here, because this is one thing that I've been beating the drum on, in that, you know, EPA comes out and says, well, we have to really improve emissions. Well, when you really tighten the screws on everything, guess what? That can hurt fuel economy. But then we have laws that say, no, you have to boost fuel economy. Mm-hmm. And, oh, by the way, you have to make the car safer, which means more structure, which means more weight, which means more emissions and more fuel economy, or, you know, more
fuel
being burned.
Yeah.
And it's gotten to the point now where, you know, in the last year we've passed rollover roof crush standards. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, the A-pillar on the car now is so thick. I mean, it's as thick as a linebacker's leg on some of these cars. And it's blocking your view for somebody coming in on the side. So for pedestrians or side traffic...
Then you got to meet the new rear visibility standard.
I drove a car recently. I can't remember what it was. It was a rental car. And I think it might have been a Nissan Versa. Small car. But it had that thick A-pillar, and just maybe just because, but it had a porthole at the base of the A-pillar. So there's all this kind of compensating
kind of
going
kind of
on.
Through that.
And then we're still, again, for the new roof crush standard, is automakers are going to what they call boron steel. It's ultra-high strength,
right.
You know, hot stamped, blah, right. Blah, 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 blah. And guess what? The jaws of life can't cut through this.
Oh, is that right?
It's absolutely true.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there is a new generation of jaws of life, but that means every municipality, every emergency, you know, first responder kind of team has got to go out and buy new jaws of life, when, of course, nobody's got the budget to go out and do this. And I'll bet nobody at NHTSA or IIHS or any of them, when they said, we're going to save all these lives, realized that emergency responders cannot cut people out of those cars.
Yeah, no, it's really been this is not a new challenge, but I think as you get into sort of the higher tech and sort of the higher demands, and you kind of get to the 98% caffeine free sort of situation where you've kind of refined things to a certain level. This is one of the most heavily regulated consumer products you're ever going to buy. I mean, unless you buy medical devices as kind of a regular thing in your life, this is probably the most heavily regulated and sort of obsessed over consumer product you're ever going to buy. And all the things you just said sort of point to the challenge these car makers have of trying to balance all these competing demands.
Hugely complex.
And while perfection
not
is...
Not to mention litigation, of course.
Not to mention litigation. And while perfection is a long way away, it's remarkable how, you know, in the last 30 years... And if your benchmark is the moment when Lee Iacocca went into Richard Nixon and basically said, you got to cut it out with these seatbelts. You know, but sometime in the 70s, you fast forward to now, the consciousness change and the technology change and the increase in sort of the quality and capability of the product is unbelievable.
But speaking of seatbelts, though, the roof crush issue is fascinating, and it's ghoulish to even talk about. But, you know, it gets down to that level of, you know, did the seatbelt spool out too much, and then did it let you hit the roof, or did the roof hit you? And then they'll fight about this, you know, till the end of time in court. And I think NHTSA was, last I talked to them a couple of years ago about on this that particular aspect of it, they was worried that the seatbelts were spooling out too much. But then, you know, if the seatbelts don't spool out enough, there's going to be seatbelt injuries. So it's always something, like you say.
Yeah.
Like the jaws of life example.
Like the jaws of life. It's the law of unintended consequences.
Right. I just did a story on the reusable bags they sell you at the store so you don't pollute the environment with the disposable bags, and they have lead in them. So you just can't win.
You can't win.
Well, you know, and I don't even blame the regulators, because, you know, most of the people that I've talked to in EPA or NHTSA, they're pretty sharp people. They know what's going on, but they've got these congressional mandates.
Want to talk about that. I think it's an interesting fact. I mean, like, I know you've been paying attention to NHTSA for a long time, but it's almost like for the last two administrations, I'm talking prior to Obama, Congress has been kind of dictating everything NHTSA did. They don't have time. I'm not sure. I mean, you know, of course, the automakers would complain about it, and in some cases, I'm not sure they're wrong. I mean, we've gotten some good laws out of that, and sure, probably every federal agency needs a kick in the behind. designed sometime to move faster. But, I mean, is that the way things should go, where Congress decides?
It's a good question. I think that Congress didn't pass a great big safety bill that they ginned up in the aftermath of this Toyota recall scandals. And given that at the time that they drafted the bill, it wasn't 100% clear what the real problem behind the Toyota recalls was. And it's somewhat more clear now. It's basically driver error, as far as we can tell. That bill might not have been the most useful piece of legislation. Yeah, because
was the one that passed after Firestone really useful? I'm not sure.
Well, either. I mean, the jury's out on that. Yeah. I mean, I think some of it probably was. I think the consciousness raising.
That's good.
The consciousness raising in the industry and in the regulator community, independent of the legislation, was probably the main good outcome of that disaster. Just as I think the consciousness raising that's gone on in the industry after Toyota. I mean, who wants to have their business, you know, slimed the way Toyota's business has been slimed? I would say the answer is nobody.
Right.
Everyone's going to get on the straight and narrow. Everyone's going to surface their problems.
Presumably, rewarding people for delaying recalls might not be.
The
practice.
Toyota's paid what? 30, 60 million, some large sum of money.
many
I now
tens
forget.
Of millions.
Tens
yeah.
of millions of dollars
right.
for as punishment for not having right. surfaced their problems in a timely way. So all of that, I think, is for the good. And whether you can legislate that down to the letter, I'm not so sure.
But I do think one of the interesting pieces on other subjects, a lot of times when there's a rush to pass a law after something like that, you know, they often are deeply flawed, as we all know. I remember somebody once did a story about the laws that are passed after, you know, missing children and things like that, and it just sometimes they just, you know, it becomes politically correct to pass them.
Well, and in the case of automobiles, you have the problem that the technology is not a stable target. The technology is a moving target,
right?
And that's, you know, that's clearly, I think that's a problem that NHTSA has. They're an agency that was set up to deal with mechanical problems. And this came out in the Toyota thing,
and
they're now dealing with a gigantic 2.5-ton computer, and they're staffing up to deal with that.
Sure didn't have the people before.
Well, we got to take another quick break here, and then I want to come back and talk about how do we fix all this. But 1 second, please, because we have to also thank Bridgestone, especially Bridgestone America's tire operation. Remember, Bridgestone is the world's largest tire company. They offer a full line of premium products, especially their Eco RFT run flat tire, low rolling resistance, and again, offers you the security and convenience of not having to stop if you get a flat. And it's Bridgestone or nothing, or as they say, Bridgestone, passion for excellence. So, hey, I see Kamatni's here. So let's bring him in on the discussion, too. Jane, swing on over. Joe, swing in, too. And let's get a microphone on. We're going great, man. Good seeing you. Hold on. Let's get a microphone on.
Hi, nice to see you. Good.
Hey, Joe White.
Hey,
how are you?
Kamatni Rowan.
So where'd you just come in from? Wait, let's get the microphone on you first.
I'll tell him. You got a great after-hours voice like that. You can call Girl Spade.
So you're coming in from where? L.A.?
L.A. I was out there for the 2012 Focus Drive.
Is that embargoed, or can you tell us what you think?
It is embargoed.
Oh, man.
So we can't know that you were there.
I can tell you it has a lot of amenities.
All right, well, let's do this, though. Okay. I want to pick up, and maybe you can speak generally about this, because this brings up something that I think is present at this show, is present at the Detroit Auto Show, and you alluded to it a couple of times. Small cars. The segment is down in terms of sales, and yet the car he can't talk about, the 2012 Focus is coming out. The car that you're a sponsor, the Chevy Cruze, is coming out. You've got the Fiat 500 from Chrysler, and someday a small car that's not a Fiat 500. You've got a couple of other small cars from GM, a new small Buick for the first time in, 10, 15 years, a small Buick. Ford is actually going to do a whole family of cars off the Focus platform. So you've got this explosion of small cars. What's going to happen?
Well, we have an explosion of small car buyers.
No, we're not. I mean, as we talked about earlier, Joe, I mean, automakers are doing this why? Not because the public is saying, I want all these small cars. No, they have to do this to meet the corporate average fuel economy standards. So it's the law that's saying, thou shalt build all these small cars, whether or not people are going to buy them. And then to your point, what if they don't? What if they don't buy them?
Yeah.
You know,
discount them.
Are we going to do? You know, is this country going to say, okay, all you bad automakers, you know, you're not getting these people to buy these cars.
Well, and, you know, and this time, if you go back a couple of product generations ago, you could say, well, the Detroit companies weren't serious because the small cars they brought in were not that good.
Exactly.
They look like, you know, tin cans, and they didn't drive all that well. I know you can't say what you experienced, but my bet is that that isn't going to be a fair accusation this time, that the cars are pretty decent.
No, they're very...
Or better than pretty decent.
No, I can say that it looks good. You know, I mean, Ford is taking a very aggressive stand on all of their designs. It's like, for example, I land and it's a bunch of snow and my wife is snowed in and, you know, lo and behold, they deliver me a, you know, 4x4 Explorer, which has the all-terrain system, a micro version from Land Rover. So I'm just trekking over, you know, pothole, snow, and everything. So it kind of saved the day.
I just won North American Truck of the Year.
This is sure the new did. Explorer.
The new Explorer, and it looks great. You know, it got some real sharp edges, some bold wheel wells, and
it's car based.
Exactly.
It's car based.
Like
yeah,
that.
It's not a big old truck anymore. Yeah. So, you know. But it does what you need it to do, even in weather like this.
Right. And my wife, she's a European Japanese lover. She doesn't like American cars, but as soon as she saw this, she's like, Explorer? This is Explorer?
Yeah, it's the first time I liked an Explorer,
exactly.
I have to say.
Yeah.
I don't like any of those big trucky trucks.
Right.
Yeah, but to see, this goes to, I think, the point you're trying to make. The Explorer has been, you know, while they were busy fixing the Focus and making it into a modern vehicle, they took the Explorer and fixed it and made it into a modern vehicle. And lo and behold, this thing gets better mileage. It's not appreciably smaller in terms of cargo space, right? It's plenty big. But it'll crawl all over the snow, but they've dealt with some of the safety and sort of architectural problems of the old Explorer. What are they really going to sell?
A lot more Explorers.
Well, I think they're going to sell a lot more Explorers. Well, I know that's the plan, and they'll
Maybe
make
people will buy one of each,
and they'll make they'll put the Focus of the Fiesta inside. And they'll make a lot more money on the Explorer. I ran into Alan Mulally at the Detroit show, and I said, what are you going to do if people don't buy the Focus? Or, I take it back. Here's what I said. What are you going to do if gas goes to $4 a gallon? He said, we got the Focus, we got the Fiesta. Mm-hmm. And are you going to make the same margins? The answer is no. They're not going to make the same margins.
Right.
So as much as they want to sell you a Focus, they really want to sell you an Explorer.
Yeah.
So it's hard to blame them if they don't market it as hard.
We'll see.
Well, they're going to have to, though, because, again, I come back, the law says thou shalt sell millions more small cars.
Yeah.
And, you know, the only thing that's going to sell them is high gasoline prices. I'm sorry, that's the end of it. We need $4 a gallon. They'll sell them all day long.
Communist. But that's the problem. That's the problem. And you're going to see that as gas is creeping up, most places over $3 a gallon, and it's winter.
Mm.
If we get to $4 a gallon and it's August, we're going to do a Back to the Future trip in Washington, D.C. We're going to go back to summer of 2008 when gas prices were $4 a gallon, and people were freaking out in this town. And you had drill, baby, drill, and the whole thing. So that whole debate could kind of come back around.
Okay, we're in D.C. You guys follow the whole D.C. scene and the auto industry and whatnot. Don't we need a better automotive policy here? I mean, you know, I talked about these conflicting regulations. Here's fuel economy standards that, you know, were written, I don't think, taking the market realities into consideration. What do you do about this?
I don't think you're going to. I mean, what you should do and what will happen is two different things. I mean, certainly they have made great inroads in making CAFE a little more fair. Someone was mentioning to me the other day, I'd never thought of this, that it always seemed odd that CAFE was part of NHTSA, but one of the automakers was saying, well, actually, that really helps because at least they know
that was what else, their idea.
Yeah, what else we're going to require. So, I mean, they seem to be getting pushed a lot in the direction probably they don't want to be on, by the environmental side, but they... at least they know what they're going to, you know, they can take into consideration how much weight they're going to add. I mean, I was talking to somebody today about some of these intelligent vehicle kinds of technologies. It's a whole other thing. They add that kind of box to it. That's, you know, it's going to add more weight, and then they won't make CAFE. But another part of DOT wants them to do that. So, you know, what are you going to do? You have EPA telling you one thing? So,
yeah.
I don't know what the answer is.
I mean, I write for the Wall Street Journal, so I can give you sort of the free market answer to that. And it is, you know, if you want people to drive around in small cars, then do what the Europeans do. I heard last night that they raised gas taxes in Europe again. And as far as I know, there has not been a revolution in, you know, the red caps have not gone back on. The pitchforks have remained in the barns. And, well, I don't know if you could get away with that here, but if you want people to buy small cars, then go out and sell that public policy to America and say, for whatever reason, you know, you need to be paying $4.55 a gallon for gas. We're going to phase it in over time, and we'll use the money to reduce the national debt or whatever you like. Now, you will not, I predict, hear anybody say that between now and 2012 at the very least, because it's just poison. And so instead we have this kind of rigged up system, which has produced some decent outcomes, but which is very complicated, very expensive, and kind of runs against the market better than half the time.
And the reality is that, you know, it's hard to downsize. You know, when we start off a country that loves big vehicles, you know, even our sedans are big SUVs, it's hard to backtrack, you know. So, you know, my wife picks me up in her Lexus ES, and we got the kids in there, and I'm like, hey, they got this Explorer over at the parking lot. Let's keep your car here. Take this. And, you know, we're just throwing stuff in there. It's much more comfortable. The 7-year-old jumps in the third row. She's sitting back there by herself. I can't feel myself with three girls and a small little vehicle, you know, whether it's a Fiesta or Mazda 3 or whatever. Our roads are big. You know, we have trailers on the road. You want to feel protected. You don't want nobody, you know, pushing you off, you know, to the, you know, to the side. So, I mean, it's a mentality. You know, how do you persuade people to switch what they've known for years and years? And unlike Europe, where they drive little cars because they have little streets, it makes sense. So I don't know if the policy is going to work, you know.
I don't see it working. Yeah. I really don't. Don't get me wrong. The new small cars are terrific, you know, and finally the Detroit 3 are starting to deliver good small cars, and they'll sell more of them. But if you look at the CAFE regulations of what they need to sell, I just don't see them selling enough of them to meet those laws.
Yeah.
As a consumer, I feel less safe in a small car. I mean, I think they're, yeah. I mean, I remember one time I had a Mini out front of my house, and a friend pulled up in his Lincoln Navigator, and I loved the Mini. And you know, if you're going to have a safe small car, it's probably one of the safest. But I'm like right there. It was a compatibility test, and it was scary. I didn't want to be on the small end of that.
But you're right. I mean, the pattern in this country, you know, with a few exceptions. I mean, I happen to like small cars personally. I mean, so, you know, I voluntarily bought several of them, and that's, and I like them, but that's fine.
That's my preference.
But in general, you're right that people buy this kind of the largest vehicle that they can afford that suits their needs. Mm-hmm. You said you have three kids?
Well, including the wife, that's
She's
the three
girl.
Girls.
Okay. Well, anyway, so there's at least four people in your vehicle,
and if
your kids are a little older, it sounds like they'll have friends.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, and if you get into that situation, you said it. I mean, you're a customer for a larger vehicle, and I think that if people got the idea that the government was making it difficult or unbearably expensive to buy a vehicle that could comfortably fit a family like yours, be big.
It's going to happen,
change.
Joe. Look, it's going to happen because, you know, the average price of a car today is already $30,000. I guarantee in 5 years it's going to be $35,000. And people are going, wait a minute, I can't buy that. That's too much money.
Right.
So what are they going to be able to afford? Small cars that they really don't want.
Yeah.
What are they going to do? They're going to hold on to their old ones as long as they can.
Well, yeah. And that's a shame because it does defeat the purpose because the difference... I think the difference between the cars that are going to be sold today, you know, going forward, and the cars that were sold even 5 years ago, or certainly 10 years ago, in terms of the safety tech on board, is enormous. It's enormous.
And you want it. You know,
you want it.
You want all these new safety systems, these new enhancements, like, you know, Mercedes, their lane assist. Not only does it assist you, but it pumps the outside brake and brings you back in.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, you want attention assist if you're dozing off, something that'll alert you. You want all these goodies, but it's like it's a premium for that, you know.
Well, when people want to, and the other thing, and this is another thing that's going to be interesting. The car makers, there's your next car. The car makers have these other kind of issues that they need to deal with. And, you know, Ford, again, pointing to Ford. Ford has had a big success, as far as I can tell, with Sync. Sort of all the, you know, kind of really integrating information and entertainment in the car. And everybody else is going to look at that and say, well, that's what we need to charge for. you know, is bringing the whole experience of that people have in their homes or, you have an iPhone, right? I saw that.
Yeah.
You know? So bringing that into your car and making that part of your environment, well, there's a whole bunch of R&D and money that has to go into that. And if you're not
They're gonna
up
be a little
on,
nervous, though, because LaHood's not so
well,
happy
right,
with some
and,
of
well, you know what? I have a prediction, I bet the car industry is going to look at the long-term customer trends of wanting to have that stuff and it being an imperative, a competitive imperative. Say that three times fast. And the likelihood that Ray LaHood will be here forever as their top regulator. And I think they're going to bet on the customer imperative.
Because when you look at some of this stuff, I mean, Sync's a good example, but navigation system, we had a long conversation about distracted driving before you got here.
Yeah.
But
we
I mean,
won't do it again.
I'm printing out MapQuest directions or trying to read directions on my BlackBerry. How could it be any less safe for me to have...
No,
you know,
it's not
be
safe.
Using a or any less safe or more... You know, it's at least safer to be using a navigation system or have it tell me which way to go.
No, what you want to be able to do is you want to be able to dock, you know, a smartphone mm-hmm. in the car, which is what the Ford system is mm-hmm. about, and be able to access all the stuff, all the apps that are on that phone, including mapping. I mean, I have a BlackBerry, which isn't a terribly sexy instrument, but it has a GPS map.
Does email well.
But it's hard to read it. It's so tight.
Well, it's especially hard to read.
I like my bigger
It's especially
screen.
Hard to read if you have old man vision like me, and you're doing this. So, but, you know, that's... People want that stuff too. They don't want to just have to get a whole bunch of spinach, which is regulated spinach. They want to have
the tasty
stuff.
Everybody wants the young drivers, so you have to have all the. I did a book on Generation Y. I mean, these kids need these cars to be, you know, portable little workstations.
Exactly.
They need iPods.
And there's a love hate relationship. You know, I look at it when iDrive first came out, and they were an early adapter of, you know, kind of integrating everything into one multimedia system. Some people couldn't adjust to it, others could. You know,
there
down
a lot
the line.
Of problems with iDrive really.
Well, the latest version is
no,
is,
I meant years ago.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
A lot of problems.
But now everyone is caught up to what iDrive is. So Ford Sync, it's the same thing. They're a little ahead of their time. So a lot in one package, and it is kind of distracting. But as we move forward, that is what we want in our car. You know, we want our car to speak to us. We want it to be intelligent. And, you know, you want to go from the house to the workplace to the car and still have the same technologies and level of information.
And you want to update your Facebook status. Do you
want
to do that?
Not
that's,
at all.
That's,
no.
No.
Wait, who's doing that? Is
that's
that OnStar?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's, yeah. Well, man, no. No.
Okay. Well, hold
I don't
on,
do it when
sec.
I'm at my desk.
Because we're going to take another quick break here for one of our sponsor messages. And we need to go to Rapid Fire, too. And I don't have internet access to get those questions. So we need to get that here. But let me take a moment here to thank another one of our sponsors, Dow Automotive. And check them out at dowaerify.com. Because that's a new type of diesel particulate filter being built in all places, Midland, Michigan.
Joe, Michigan.
Yeah, there you go. And this stuff is really going to catch on. It's high efficiency particulate filtration, low back pressure. You can downsize it, upsize it, because it's going to be used as retrofits on big trucks in California and on off-road equipment and on light vehicles. So pretty interesting. Check it all out at dowaerify.com. And Aerify is AERIFY, so that's dowaerify.com. And so we've got some questions coming in from our viewers right now. We'd like to do this fast. We'll see if we can do it. Okay, so boom, here we go. George from Brooklyn wants to know, why don't more cars have heads-up displays? Why not, Jane? You were talking about, you know, looking at...
What does he literally mean, like the things on the...
Where it's up on the windshield.
Well, you know, I actually don't remember why they got rid of that. People found it distracting, I think, wasn't it?
I think it's cost.
I don't actually
They still
remember.
Have it. BMW has it.
A few of them have it, but I guess why don't more? I actually don't know.
I think you'll see more of it.
It's
partly
a long time, though.
It has. I think they tried to sell it as an option, and it was expensive, and like people said, why?
They're coming up with less costly ones. But
right.
I'll tell you what the next one is. You know when you watch football games and, you know, the 10-yard line is that miracle yellow line imposed on the screen. The next generation of head-up display with navigation is going to light up the road that you're supposed to follow. So instead of looking at a map, the road is literally going to be lit up in terms of where you've got to go
to drive.
It's
also flashing your speed limit, right? I mean, your speed.
Well, that's for heads-up display. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
I like that myself. I need it.
I think it's going to be way cool. Unsprung wants to know, what is Automotive Rhythms?
Automotive Rhythms is a multimedia auto company, which we review and evaluate new vehicles, SUVs, and bikes, just like yourself and Consumer Reports. But we take a lifestyle approach and synergize entertainment, music, technology around the new car reviews. So we just make car talk a little bit cooler.
Cool. I like that. I like that a whole lot. Comment from Jesse. On a side note, can someone put the word out that ethanol gets less gas mileage and may hurt the car's internals? We'll debate this. Nobody in the feel-good world seems to ever bring this up. Well, I would say, yeah, ethanol, you will get less gas mileage. It's 30% less energy
less
density.
Less energy density, yeah.
Right. So you will see it go down. Hurt the car's internals? Guess what? All gasoline right now has about 10% ethanol in it. So your car has been running on it. All Indy cars run on ethanol. It's got an octane rating of over 110. You can do some pretty good stuff with it.
But it is interesting you don't hear that very much. I mean, you don't hear much negative talk about ethanol.
No, I that's all I hear is negative stuff. Joe and I had dinner last night.
As John knows, I can supply the negative talk about ethanol.
Yeah.
And I want to be clear that I'm not necessarily taking a position on it. But I can supply the negative view.
Because people tell you negative things, right?
No, because I'm aware of it. It's a political problem or an issue, and I think it will become more of a political issue as we go forward here. Number one, there's a great concern that you're placing food supplies or the land that would grow food by growing ethanol, hence rising food prices, which is a problem probably more so in other countries than in here, but it's a problem. Number two,
but all food prices are going up. I'll point out, not just corn.
Well, right. I mean, but corn. Corn's
futures well, are a great investment corn, right now, and that's got nothing to do with ethanol.
But corn is an important commodity in a bunch of different foods. So, but there is that argument that it drives up food prices. Number two, there's a view the environmental a fairly significant segment of the environmental community has walked on ethanol because they're concerned that it doesn't really solve the climate. Carbon dioxide issue.
Well, they kind of changed their position.
They were pushing it for a long time, and now people like Al Gore famously basically disavowing ethanol and saying, corn ethanol. I was only for it because I had to win in Iowa. He said this, and it's something like out of the West Wing. There was actually a West Wing episode where they said, so, and then the third thing, and then I'll drop it, is you know, in case you hadn't noticed, we've got a $1.5 trillion budget deficit in this country, and the Congress is looking annual, and the Congress is looking around for things to cut, and this particular program might just come up in the crosshairs with the very large proviso that the farm state lawmakers and the farm lobby is as powerful. Are as powerful as they ever were, so we'll see.
Yeah, we have to cut that ethanol subsidy
that
so
wasn't
we can
a fast
go subsidize
answer, anyway,
electric cars.
Go back to rapid fire.
Yeah, that's right.
Jim wants to know, did any of the cars debut at the DC show, or is it basically a repeat of cars that were at the Detroit show? Repeat.
No, I didn't know if anything
did.
I don't think there was
anything.
It's
a repeat.
But a few years ago, there'd be like some obscure Subaru model or something would be launched. But I don't
the
even
road
think
in
they
Cherry
tried
Hill,
that.
So they just
right. I didn't see. I walked through the Subaru stand. I didn't see anything.
Look, the value of the DC show is not the cars.
Yeah.
It's getting to the regulators and the legislators
exactly.
who are here in town.
Anything.
And it's seeing green cars.
Right. Let's see, 007, Mitch W. wants to know, what's the truth about Carol Browner's taking a leave of absence? A leave of administration is the way he puts it. Is that right?
She did not confide in me. I have no idea. I don't have good sources on that. Anybody else?
Yeah. She's left the administration.
Yeah.
That I know.
Okay, Skemson wants to know, if Hyundai brought their diesel V6 to the U.S., would it finish off overshadowing other imports? It would put the Camry, Accord, Jetta, and Taurus in the back seat.
I mean, not really. There still needs to be more education on what diesel is in the U.S., the clean diesel, you know, blue tech, and the power of the power density of diesel and the extra mileage you can achieve from it. So I think we're still a long way from people just switching over from gasoline to diesel. The tech heads know. You know, what diesel can do for a vehicle, some 600-mile range and some VWs, but the general population is still in the waters on that.
Okay, we're going to try to take a call-in question here, and let's see if I can make this work right. And no, that didn't work.
Give me one more chance here.
You got your not-so-smartphone there?
Well, the phone is pretty smart. It's the dude running it that is good.
It's the driver.
Hit the speaker icon.
Hey, Joe, I'm Rick from San Diego. I was wondering if anyone ever really addressed the problem of electric vehicle charging when the electric power goes out for like 3 days, which happens occasionally in the winter back there.
Happening right now all over our area. Yeah. I never thought of that.
The question is, what happens if your power goes out? What do you do with your electric car then?
You park it.
You have a generator.
Yeah.
That's why you need 3 or 4 cars.
Yeah.
Yeah, there you go. That's, you know, I hadn't thought of that.
Would it work with a generator?
That's obviously but if you have one.
Yeah.
But that would be a problem.
It would definitely be a problem.
He raises a good question.
That's a really good question.
But if you don't want to go to work that day, it's a great excuse.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, it's not going to be a standalone vehicle. You know, for the next few years. Like you said, you'll need to. It'll be a second or third car.
Right.
That's just, it's stressful.
I think this is kind of obvious, but I'll say it anyway. I think what you're going to see is electric vehicles are going to start out being mainly purchased by the government, corporate fleets, and affluent individuals who can afford to have two or three or four cars, one for every person purpose.
Right. No, that's where it's going to make all the sense in the world, you know, with multi-car families or households that go.
And the rest of us are going to buy, as I think as we've done for a long time, the vehicle that we can afford that serves the highest ultimate use that we can imagine needing. Mm-hmm. You know, 5 kids going to a soccer game, I'm going to buy for that use, even though 6 days out of 7 I'm not using it that way.
I mean, I only have 1 kid, and I frequently say, geez, I wish I had a vehicle with 7 seats right now.
I got
a husband and a kid. And it's,
you know, life can put you in a situation where you need to have a sizable vehicle. Yeah. I have a sister-in-law, brother and sister-in-law, who 2 years ago had twins, on, you know, in addition to their 5-year-old.
Right.
Well, you know, it's like we're going to Disney World, we're buying a minivan because, you know,
that's it, and not
a small one either, not a C-Max.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Although they could fit the kids in the C-Max. I don't know. Did they show you the C-Max? Can you say that?
No. I've driven the C-Max. It's a cool vehicle. But we got a question for Jane from Annette Haynes in McLean, Virginia. She asks, is it hard to find topics geared towards automotive subjects in such a non-automotive area in the country? And she goes on to say, all the women appreciate your column in USA Today from a woman's perspective. And P.S., I love my Duramax diesel for my daily driver.
All right.
So is it hard to find subjects in this area to write up?
With the government here, I mean, I do end up towards those sorts of things. I mean, there's no shortage of government officials and safety advocates with story ideas. So that's why, I mean, my beat is considered, I'm a consumer reporter, so I do a little bit of everything. But, yeah, there's no shortage.
And one for you, Joe. Could Joe White explain why accident avoidance technology only works up to about 20 miles an hour?
First of all, I think they're going to change that. Second of all, I think that there's a car makers are anxious about this technology. They really need to be certain that it's going to work.
Liability reasons, yeah.
It's got to work 100% of the time.
Every time it needs to work.
Every time.
They're not going to prevent
kidding,
fatality.
No fooling, no excuses. And I think they're being, we talked
cautious
to some people at BMW about this. What they could do and what they're doing in the market are two different things right now, because they want to be sure that it's going to work.
Yeah, it's our litigious society is holding back technology, literally. Jay Cujo wants to know, is the Buick Regal Turbo really as bad as Mark Phelan says it is? Mark Phelan reviews cars in the Detroit Free Press. He says it got 2 stars. I haven't driven the Buick Regal Turbo. Have you, Kamatni?
Yeah, I've driven it.
What do you think?
I mean, it feels good, but, you know, it's not a 3 Series. I mean, so it's all about your expectations of the vehicle. You can't compare it to what it's not, you know. So if you're looking at it as a European knockoff, no, it's not that. You know, it's just a quicker Regal.
I kind of liked it. They used to tease me at work. I always liked Buicks. I mean, I'd buy one, but, I mean, it's kind of got that nice feel as I get older. I like a nice, smooth ride, and
I think Buick could be a real hot brand.
I think so, too. And the young
cool
people, they don't have these preconceived notions
that
it's an old person's car. It could be hip all over again.
Right. I went to a Buick party in Miami, and it was just like all young college kids. And I was like, is this the new Buick? And they're like, we're trying.
Buick was saying that.
Yeah, Buick. Yeah. I mean, the cars definitely look good.
Were the kids there because the drinks were free or because they like the car?
I haven't driven the cars, but I'm
sure the drinks had something to do with it.
Yeah. I haven't driven the cars, but I agree that, I mean, compared to where they were a few years ago, the presentation is 100% better. Now, whether they're following the mechanicals and the whole experience delivers on the way the car looks, I don't know because I haven't driven it.
They don't have those cheesy GM dashboards.
I think it's probably
that's right.
It's probably a good thing that young Chinese buyers are going to drive the Buick brand.
That's why we still have it.
From here on, that's why we still have it.
Otherwise, they would have killed it. I'm telling
you,
man.
For sure.
Right. Let's see here. David wants to know, will the Pentastar V6 be available in the 2012 Jeep Wrangler?
I'm not sure.
I don't know. But all I can say is they want to put that Pentastar V6 in everything. So I'd say there's probably a good chance it would end up in the Wrangler. That's my guess. Okay, this is probably good for you, Jane. Has late Ray LaHood been possessed by a demon with his complete focus on distracted driving despite criticism from highway safety advocates like the former transportation secretary?
I didn't know that the former transportation secretary criticized it, but the former head of NHTSA, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, criticize it. I certainly don't think he's possessed by the devil, and I think his motivations are probably pure. I just think that there's an awful lot of people with an awful lot of years of safety experience who think it should be more, a campaign like that should be more focused on the research.
Good answer. George from Brooklyn says, what does John think of the new Passat? Like I said before, I'm glad they told me it was the new Passat because otherwise I would have thought it was the new Jetta. So it's a good thing they pointed that out to me. But I will say there's a ton of backseat room, pretty decent interior. I got to drive the thing. I haven't driven it yet, so that's all I can say right now. Glenn wants to know, did anyone sit in a Fiat 500 yet? I was wondering how much room was inside up front. Come on, you been in the 500?
Yeah, I actually had a test drive last week when we were driving the CLS 63 AMG, and we wound up having lunch at the same spot. So you got the Fiat's pulling up and then us in the AMG. So everybody starts switching out. But surprisingly, it is pretty roomy up in the front. And one of my counterparts, Brian Armstead, is 6'9", and he had no problem fitting in it.
Yeah, I've driven the Fiat 500 because I was on the 500 trip. That I was in San Diego a week ago. But, I would say this. The back seat is a tight squeeze. I'm not a big guy. I'm 5'8". There was not enough rear seat headroom for me unless I ducked my head. And there's a couple of other tall guys on the trip were saying they had plenty of headroom up front as long as there's no sunroof. With the sunroof, they had to duck their heads, too.
So it's basically a two-seater.
It's basically a two-seater or, very small kids in the back or something like that. I think we've gotten really to them all. And besides, we're at the top of the hour, so I think we can wrap up here.
Okay, it was fun.
It's a wrap.
Yeah. Jane O'Donnell, USA Today, great having you here. Joe White, Wall Street Journal, great having you. Kamatni Rollins with Automotive Rhythms, great having you here.
Sorry for my tardiness, but...
Well, hey, you can't help.
I told
your producer, I'll do what I can do.
Yeah. Had a good question. You got to give a whole
explanation. It's tough changing in the dark,
And again, we want to thank our sponsors, Bridgestone, Chevrolet, and Dow Automotive Systems. Remember, you can always friend us at facebook.com/OutOfLineDetroit. Follow us at twitter.com/OutOfLine. Don't forget Peter DeLorenzo's Auto Extremist Rants at autoextremist.com. Kamatni, where's your website?
You can check us out at autoiconic.com or same on Facebook /automotive rhythms.
And Wall Street Journal, WSJ.
J.com.
WSJ.
Ice on the Road is my column about the car business.
Ice on the Road is your
column. It's my column about the car business, yeah.
I also have a book website that talks about gets into cars a bit, genbuy.com. The book is genbuy, G-E-N-B-U-Y.
Oh, cool.
Congratulations.
Yeah.
Genbuy.net, excuse me.
Oh, glad you caught it. And do you have a column by name or just look for your stuff?
USA Today. No, I write a couple times a week. And it's so anytime you can search me on usatoday.com.
Way cool. Well, thank you all. This has been great.
Thanks for having us.
Nice being here.
Good to be here.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence. Chevrolet, the all-new Chevrolet Cruze. Get used to more. And by Dow Automotive Systems, innovations for clean powertrain solutions.